Welcome to another episode of Congo Kids Life Stories, where I share my experiences of growing up in the Congo in Central Africa. My hope is you find knowledge, entertainment, information, and insight of another culture and a new perspective of the Congolese people and Africa. Welcome back to Trials and Triumphs in Congo, a 100-year mission journey. The series about the history of the establishment of the Evangelical Free Church mission work in the northwest corner of Congo in the Ubangi region. As previously mentioned, the Free Church was started in 1884 when 22 churches, comprised mainly by Swedish immigrants with similar beliefs of church government and biblical doctrines, agreed to cooperate to support home and foreign missions. The goal of the mission effort was to share the gospel to the world, and specifically to Congo, to start churches and train up leaders to continue with the work of the church autonomously. I decided to do this series on the history of the Free Church mission work because my family was part of the effort for 25 years in the 1960s through 1990. Many of the events in this series involved me and my parents. Much of the early work had helped establish a functioning mission, but much happened also during my family's tenure, so I felt that sharing the journey from the beginning, as well as the stories of all those that passed away during the effort, was important. Furthermore, there is a lot of information and history that will be shared that has never been heard or documented, and I'm glad to have captured it to preserve it for future generations. This is episode 6 of 7. As a brief recap, the first episode told the story of the work of the Free Church mission starting in the early 1920s, led by the vision of Titus Johnson, resulting in 3 stations up and running by 1936. The second episode covered adding 3 more mission stations from 1936 to 1947 and several people being buried in Congo, succumbing to disease and illness. Episode 3 covered the period from 1948 to 1952, where more mission stations were established. Several people passed away as well. Episode 4 included more stations being established and the beginning of transferring responsibility to the Congolese church. Congo's independence occurred in 1960, resulting in the evacuation of the missionaries. 3 more saints were laid to rest, 2 infants and an adult. Episode 5 covered the period from 1963 to 1972, where there was a rebellion and evacuation and the government's policies of nationalizing everything. Episode 6 will cover 1973 to 1997, with not 1, but 2 evacuations of the missionaries. And sadly, more people are buried.
And how can anyone preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. Romans 10:15.
The early 1970s was fraught with change in the formal model of how the missionaries worked with the church. This was partly due to the Congolese church wanting and taking more responsibility of its operations, but also due to the government's policies. The government was attempting to unify the country with the concept of eliminating all things European and making all things authentically Congolese. They changed the country's name, and there was a crackdown on Christianity. Yet, the missionaries adapted and adjusted to continue their ministries. They continued to teach in the various mission high schools and impact the students. One such teacher was a short-termer at Bado, serving a 2-year commitment. Clarice Audrey Hogberg was from Mission Covenant Church in Stanton, Iowa. She'd received her college degree in French and then was a junior and senior high school French teacher in Nebraska. I was able to track down Clarice's brother and sister in Iowa. Her older brother, Dr. Maynard Hogberg, shared with me Clarice's desire to serve God as a teacher.
Once she graduated from here, from Iowa State, she did take a teaching job in Seward, Nebraska. And then once she had applied for the International Farm Youth Exchange Program. And so when she got accepted into that, then of course France was one of her, with her French language, she went there and spent time staying with different families while she was there. And I think that probably got her thinking about what internationally, what she could possibly do and what she may have interest in, that eventually probably led her then when she came back, along with her upbringing in the church, a place of where she could go and make a difference. And that's when she applied to go there to Gavotto to teach French in the school.
In the early 1970s, she then left for Congo on a 2-year short-term teaching assignment at Bado. She was a thoughtful, hardworking teacher, stressing excellence of her students. But less than a year into her time, she became ill. She tried to continue her teaching, but was relegated to bed for a few weeks. Her condition got worse, so she was moved to the local hospital. Nurse Jody Levon accompanied her to Loco. Dr. Almquist tried to figure out how to help her, yet her condition continued to deteriorate. The mission sent a telegram to her family back in the States to notify them of her severe illness. Mary Ann Algren, a nurse, flew to Loco to accompany her to Carowa on the flight. When they arrived at Loco, she was in a coma. Mary Ann had to hold Clarice down on the flight as the noise and movement caused her to move around a lot. Here is Mary Ann.
I said to the pilot, please call ahead to Carowa and tell one of the doctors to be there at the when we land, which they did, and we took her to one of the homes that was not occupied. It was what we called a duplex between where Thorpe's lived and the pilot's house. And she was there for the duration of the time. And at first, we nurses took turns taking care of her, but everybody still had their regular work to do. And so I ended up being there for caring for her for 36 hours. She was not getting any better, no matter what we did. And Dr. Thorpe thought that one possibility that might help would be if we exchanged blood, took some out and put blood donation from someone else in.
At Carowa, her health continued to deteriorate. They thought hepatitis was the cause, and they were out of options. Radio consultations with all the doctors and nurses in the Ubangi were held to help figure out the course of action. Missionaries and Congolese were praying in the region, literally 24/7. Dr. Roger Thorpe finally decided to try a full blood transfusion to see if that would help. Barbara Johnson, a nurse helping during this time, recalls Dr. Roger saying,
"Our backs are against the wall. No doctor should have to make this decision."
The request for blood type O positive was radioed to every mission station.
And so we sent out word on the radio to ask the missionaries from the different stations to come and donate their blood. And during the night, from time to time, you could hear a truck coming up the hill to Carowa Station. We knew that was someone else coming to donate their blood.
Nurses and doctors tended to her around the clock. Mary Ann recalls walking to the hospital one evening to get more tubes for the blood transfusion, and a Congolese lab technician stopped her and asked if he too could donate blood to help. The stress of Clarice's condition, the long hours caring for her, and seemingly hopeless situation was too much for Mary Ann, and she broke down in tears, recognizing the genuine care and love of this Congolese who only wanted to help.
But she really never got any better, as far as we could tell. She remained unconscious and just going downhill. And until one morning after I had been there all night, and she died. And I think that Dr. Roger Thorpe was there. I think it was just the two of us. I'm not sure.
As Mary Ann mentioned, her body succumbed, and Clarice passed away at 5:45 a.m., just at sunrise. I remember that day, as Aunt Ruth Ann Peterson, the dorm mother, came down the boys' hall around 6:10 a.m. that morning and stood in my doorway with tears in her eyes.
"Clarice went to be with the Lord today."
It was Friday, April 27th, 1973. A radio message was relayed, and a telegram was sent to her family in the States about her passing.
We had sent word to Kinshasa to David Lundblad in the travel agency there, and he had connection with headquarters, and they notified her parents in, I believe it was Iowa, that she had died. Well, they had known that she was sick and that we were doing everything we could. And we asked them if they wanted to have her body sent home, but they decided that she should be buried at Kiowa.
The carpenters got to work to build a wooden coffin. Someone searched through their stuff to find white satin fabric with which to line the coffin. There was a memorial service for her that day at 4 p.m., and all the missionaries and the kids at the Ubangi Academy attended the service. Recall that most of the missionaries from the area were already there as they'd driven in to donate blood. The church was packed, and several hundred Congolese were in the yard outside the church. The Ubangi Academy choir, of which I was a part, sang, "Be Still My Soul," during the service. Numerous missionaries and Congolese pastors shared from the pulpit. After the church service, the group moved to the Kiowa Cemetery and a graveside service was held. Many Congolese mentioned her love for the students and accepted that God called her to heaven, even though she still wanted to continue teaching her students. So the 16th saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, Clarice Hogberg.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
Kathy Almquist, a childhood friend of mine, on a phone call, mentioned her memory of an incredible sunset that day. John Lundquist, also a childhood friend of mine, recalls that day well, as the sunset that evening was magnificent.
As we were leaving the burial site, it was sunset, and I was in the back of a pickup truck, and so I had a really good view of the sky. And it was the most spectacular sunset I ever have seen. I looked carefully at it. It was one half of the entire sky. And it was a greater range of colors than I've ever seen. And they were all vivid. I don't know if there was any color missing from that sunset. All the oranges and reds, all that you'd expect. And plus there was other unusual colors like blues and greens and whatever in it. It was just amazing. Never seen anything like it. I was moved by it because it seemed like look at that, I'm moved again. It seemed like a message from God.
In my research, I found a letter that described the sunset as being absolutely gorgeous, thus collaborating Kathy and John's memory. In a sad twist of fate, the first telegram advising her family of her illness didn't arrive until after the second telegram had been delivered, notifying the family of her passing. The doctors later confirmed that she had indeed died of liver failure. The family's sense of loss and how they accepted the news is shared by Dr. Maynard.
Our parents certainly had no remorse or anything about it. I think my dad took it the hardest to begin with, and then later my mother probably finally got to her. It was the fact that she was gone, but they weren't blaming anybody because they knew that the risk when she signed up to go over there, and they knew that was probably part of God's will. We hated to see her leave and go, but we knew that's what she wanted to do, and so you never clip the wings of people. You want to give that, let them spread their wings and do what they think they want to do and what they're led to do. But I don't think there's anybody ever felt that there was anybody to blame or anything else.
Dr. Maynard and Clarice's older sister, Ramona, recall the memorial service held on May 6th, 1973, at her home church in Iowa.
Well, there was a big crowd of people there, and the pastor, his sermon was apparently effective to those that attended because many people commented on it afterwards.
Yeah, it was really an uplifting ceremony too. It needed to be because people had to be thinking that this is part of God's plan. We need to move forward. We're very thankful that she was able to have an impact there while she was there.
Someone recorded both the Congo church service and graveside service on a cassette tape recorder. This was later translated into English and typed up and given to Clarice's family back in the U.S.
It was hard to get closure because the body never came back. In fact, she was buried before we knew about it. or my parents knew about it. And then they called me right away, as soon as they got a call. But there's no closure when you, a lot of times when you go through a services, when they, you don't see the body or anything else to have closure. I think that message of the, that of the service there and how much people appreciate her, that was very touching and very moving, and that helped a lot in the healing process that was needed. The slides came back, and then we saw the beautiful sunset at the cemetery. That all really helped bring this to closure a lot more.
Then, on November 21st, 1973, at 6 a.m., a small graveside service was held, and a brass plaque was placed on her grave. The plaque was from her family to formally memorialize her passing and permanently identify the grave. Dr. Maynard confirmed that no family member has ever visited her grave. Clarice's life did impact people in the short time she was there. Some funds were raised and sent to the Botto School. Ramona shares how Clarice's legacy lives on.
My daughter was about 7 when Clarice died, and when she grew up, she named her daughter Clarice.
A new kind of nationalization was decided upon by the government in late 1973. Foreigners could no longer own plantations or businesses. Only Zaire citizens could own property or businesses. So some Belgian or Portuguese business owners transferred their plantation or stores to local people and stayed on as employees. Others tried to sell their lifelong business effort for pennies on the dollar. Most walked away as they had no other choice. This obviously messed up imports and exports and other supply chain issues, putting the economy into a tailspin for the country. For the mission, their property was deeded to the Congolese church. Yet, the government kept pushing religion out of the country as much as possible. Church leaders had to attend a, quote, school of Mobutuism, unquote, for a 45-day session. Also, prayer meetings and other gatherings were suspect, and there was a concern about religious literature being printed and other behaviors that had been normal and accepted just a few years prior. Talk about indoctrination and a police state environment right out of the communist playbook. Wow. The push for authenticity continued, and in some regards was probably being made up on the fly since it was rolled out in 1971. Another step the government took to take control of eliminating all things Western in an effort to unite the country was to take over the schools. In 1974, the government issued a decision to nationalize the schools. The government would take them over. Buildings, housing for the teachers, the offices where the school business was conducted, and all equipment. This new mandate would take effect January 1, 1975. Furthermore, religion could not be taught, and the teachers would be under the control of the government. So though the government was to provide teachers, they depended on the missionary teachers to keep classes going for several years. The church fought this for several years, then acquiesced and let the government run everything, thus relieving themselves of the staffing and financial responsibility. And though the school campuses were on formerly mission property, where rules and ethics had prevailed, things started to go sideways. Fast. Salaries weren't always paid, and many Congolese teachers ran amok with drinking, gambling, polygamy, promiscuity with female students, and many other things. And the mission and church had no say. My, my, what a few years make from when the mission ran things to having the church take over and now the government. The other thing the CECU did was to declare that since teachers hadn't been placed in those positions by the church, and they couldn't teach religion in the schools, and that the schools were nationalized anyways, that the missionary teachers weren't real missionaries. That was a blow to a missionary teacher's morale for sure. So many former teachers went home on furlough and just didn't return. Bob Dylan, the Free Church executive director from the States, reminded the church leaders that it was through the schools for the past decades that had trained and raised up church leaders and workers. And part of the success and growth of the church was because of the educational ministry the Free Church had been involved with and guided over many years. The mission effort had to pivot, and relied on ministries with the students to be outside of the classroom. Many had home Bible studies, showed films, had Bible correspondence courses, and other outreach ministries. Furthermore, they promoted the Theological Education by Extension, or TEE. This was a series of courses that would be taught in villages to pastors and other church leaders, and the curriculum was administered by a missionary or Congolese pastor. As you have heard, from 1970 to 1975 was complete upheaval and turmoil, with the missionaries, the local church, and government bringing extreme change to the mission model that had been in place for decades. There had been talk in the 1960s about the process of transitioning the leadership and responsibilities of the church to the Congolese. And ultimately, this was the mission's goal, right? Nils, also known as Ole Olbergs, wrote a master's thesis in the early 1970s about this time period. The following are portions of a paragraph from his thesis. I've asked his son, David Olberg, to quote this.
In 1974, Richard Anderson suggested that there be a gradual disengagement of missionaries from the Ubangi. He wrote again about this in 1975. This was not meant to be a disengagement forced by the intolerable circumstances, but a planned retreat which would benefit the church by allowing it to assume more of the positions occupied by missionaries. As the months passed, working conditions at the Tondela Hospital deteriorated for the missionary personnel. There was a real reluctance on the part of the nurses to become more involved with the nurses' training program, and they decided on guidelines for determining the point at which they would withdraw from the medical program entirely. The mission executives were considering the necessity of asking certain missionaries not to return. It seemed that complete nationalization of the hospital would become a fact in the near future. As the year drew to a close, the mission seemed on the verge of the gradual disengagement advocated by the field secretary, Richard Anderson.
So as you just heard, the future of the Free Church mission work continuing on was not a certainty. Ole Olberg also provided the following statistics from 1975.
There were approximately 350 organized churches of the Seikyu, with about 250 pastoral workers, including 23 ordained pastors. The church membership was about 14,500 financially contributing, baptized believers who were in good standing with the church. The actual number of church members is not known, but would include many more who were unable to contribute to the financial support of the church, including youth and old people. 36 missionaries remained on the Ubangi field at that time.
So from essentially 1922 to 1975, a span of 53 years, this was the quantification of the Free Church efforts in the Ubangi region. In late 1973, Dr. Titus had returned home to Sweden for Christmas and was en route to the U.S. when he suddenly collapsed outside the bus station. Taken to the hospital, there was no reviving him. It was January 16, 1974. He was planning to return to Congo, as in one of his last letters written, received post-mortem, he wrote,
I am returning to the Ubangi. I can't shake Congo from my blood.
In typical form, Titus was moving on to the next task, the next adventure, when he was so abruptly stopped. The message quickly circulated by cable and telephone to America and to Sweden and to Congo. Tito was dead. Unthinkable. Impossible. The cable messages turned into radio messages and Africa log drum messages being beaten out and the news being passed from village to village, spreading the message throughout the Ubangi region. He who parted the grass, the healer, the one who worked side by side with them and loved them, Titu Akufi, Titu. Afia, translated, such sorrow, T Tito is dead. Such sorrow. Titus is dead. Titus had wanted to die in Africa, but that was not to be. His nephew led the funeral service in Sweden, and he preached from Psalm 84. The inscription on his gravestone in Sweden is a simple one.
Right so, you good and trusted servant, missionary and doctor, Titus Johnson, 1897 to 1974.
His home church in Wheaton, Illinois, held a memorial service and was attended by numerous people, representatives, and dignitaries. Eulogies, stories, and many words were shared about this incredible man and his life and impact. Everyone was in shock, and it seemed surreal that he was gone. The Free Church mission in Congo was and is because of Titus Johnson. The Congolese church, now over 100 years old and flourishing, is because he saw the need and pursued it with zeal, with literally nothing but faith in God. A special man indeed. He had a vision and a drive and made it happen. And even the reminders of his blemished humanity, his over-effusive youth, the blunders of his adult years, his tempers, his inconsistencies, his failures, serve only to remind us of ourselves and our own humanity and of the grace of God on which we all depend. Dr. Wally Thornblum, who worked with him throughout his life, noted,
"You won't capture him."
Well stated, and a poignant summary of Dr. Titus Johnson. He couldn't be contained. But his life story is for you to remember and to help you on your own way to know the great spirit that was and is Dr. Titus Johnson. Though he didn't die on the mission field, the 17th saint returned to glory. Rest in peace, Dr. Titus Johnson. Rest in peace, Tito.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
The church realized the importance of advanced training for their pastors and church leadership. The Bible Institutes at Goyongo and Bado were graduating students with good biblical training, but advanced college-level training was needed as the church grew. A few promising students had to go to Kinshasa or another country for graduate-level seminary training. Several African church associations began discussions in the late 1960s and early 1970s to pool resources and start a seminary catering to French-speaking countries. It was an ambitious project with a large startup budget of $500,000. It would be in Bangui, Central African Republic, just across the border from the Ubangi region. One of the founders of the school was quoted as saying,
"To me, the great need in Africa today is ministerial training, coupled with an in-depth teaching in the church. We should make an effort to convince missionaries and Christian leaders that while evangelism should not be neglected, teaching the converts we already have should be our priority. A well-taught Christian will become an evangelist."
In 1977, the Bangui Evangelical School of Theology opened. This was a university-level school with the goal of graduating trained pastors that would then be ordained and help with the leadership of the church growth. The wives also had training for their future roles with women's ministries. Many promising Bible students from the CECU and CEUM attended the Bangui Evangelical School of Theology. They then went on to have critical roles within church leadership. Several became the president of the Congo Free Church denomination or the Covenant Congo denomination. It was in the mid-1970s that the church decided to sponsor the translation of the Bible into the Mbaka language, as that was the predominant tribal group in the area. Wycliffe Bible translators were brought in, and a team of Congolese translators were selected from the Free Church and Covenant churches to be part of this project. Elaine Thomas and Margaret Hill were the translation coordinators from Wycliffe. Jay Dangers built the house for them at the Gemina Station property. The Bible translation was a project that took many years as computers were not being used at that time, so most work was done by hand or typewriter. The New Testament was finished in 1983. A joint Free Church and Covenant celebration service was held at Bokonzo Church on May 22, 1983. It was a big event with dignitaries from the U.S. mission boards and local authorities. There was even a band that Roger Eels assembled from Institute Kimya. For the first time, the Ngbaka pastors and people could read God's word in their mother tongue. The Old Testament was completed in 1995. So now this large tribe in our area, the Ngbakas, had scripture in their mother tongue. I interviewed Margaret Hill before she passed away about the translation process, and it is fascinating. If you are interested, you can learn all about it in episode 13 on my website, congokid.net. You've heard about Zongo, going back to Titus Johnson and his travels. It was located directly across from Bangui, Central African Republic, which was a modern city. During the early decades of the mission work, the missionaries simply passed through it on their way to and from Bangui, as they would buy supplies or enjoy some modern luxuries they couldn't have in Congo. It was also where immigration and customs functions were conducted, being the border town that it was. There was no property owned by the mission there, so they would stay at a rest house or the only hotel. In 1945, Will Norton explored the area up near Zongo and beyond. It was on the outskirts of the current mission work. He determined that having a presence in that area was needed. The church then sent two Congolese pastor evangelists to the area, and by 1950, six churches had been established. In the early to mid-1970s, a Belgian named Mr. Daniel arrived at Zongo. He wasn't part of the Free Church. He was flying solo. His ministry was evangelism and development. He was teaching building techniques to the Congolese. He was there for a short time, but his relationship with the Free Church missionaries wasn't the best. Eventually, he had to return to Belgium as he didn't have official status for working with the mission. So his lack of proper paperwork resulted in his leaving Zongo. A letter was circulated by Ron Myers, the field chairman, on March 28, 1977. It was sent to the field missionaries and the home board. In this letter was the desire to establish a mission station at Zongo. The Congolese church, the CECU, had a church in Zongo on a small parcel of property. They agreed to allow a missionary presence there. The property was located a few kilometers from the center of town where the ferry was located, at the top of a hill. The view of the Ubangi River and the city of Bangui was spectacular. Jack and Jean Dangers moved to Zongo to build the house in the summer of 1979. Jack didn't quite finish the construction. Then Jack and Flo Lashbaugh went to Zongo, and Jack finished the interior of the house. Later, a small storeroom was added to the property. The Lashbaughs were there for about 3.5 years. They did training and pastoral ministries all over the area. Years later, in April 1997, a dispensary was added to the compound. In the early 1980s, shipping containers became a part of supplying the mission work and hospital work, and Zongo became critical in that transportation process. Containers could be sent to Douala, Cameroon on the west coast of Africa and trucked overland to Bangui. It was about an 850-mile trip. By the way, I made that drive in a pickup truck in February 1983. Check out episode 2 on my podcast for that story if you're interested. I remember spending 4 days at Zongo in February 1983 with Merle Wester, helping get 3 shipping containers across the river and through customs. These were filled with medical supplies, equipment, and often personal effects for the missionaries' homes. The logistics of getting these across the river on a ferry, transported to the mission station, through customs, and then trucked to the proper hospital or mission station was a huge endeavor. With the many folks traveling to and from Bangui, along with the freight and supplies in shipping containers, Zongo was a key part of the mission's supply chain and operations. Yet, having missionaries there to help on the logistics end was not the only reason for staffing Zongo. The northern area the church was working in needed Zongo as a base. The Bavula area in the north and east had minimal support, so the folks at Zongo were part of ministering to this isolated area. I've asked Jim Aiken, who grew up in Congo and then served 2 years in Bangui, Central African Republic, as a builder and gopher in the mid-1980s, to elaborate about Zongo. Jim frequented Zongo as he was instrumental in shuttling people and shipping containers between Bangui and Zongo. So what was the station's description?
So Zongo actually had two houses and a church on it. It was on top of a little hilltop overlooking the second set of rapids between Zaire and Central African Republic, Bangui. They did have some storage there. It was a really small house. It was not the easiest place to get to. I would have the guys in the pirogue canoes drop me there if I was going to spend the night or spend the day and just walk up the hill. Or if we had wheels, we could go around. But it took a good 15 minutes to get there because it was just rocks as a road, pretty bad.
What was the original intent of setting up a mission station at Zongo?
The Free Church on the field had an interest in trying to get evangelism and get pastors up that coastline there. And because we just didn't have any, you couldn't get there except through that avenue of Zongo. So Zongo was the ideal place.
How did the compound get their water?
In the early days, we had our own pump that we pumped up from the river. It's just a gas pump that you fired up, and it had a couple of lift stations on it, you know, so that the water could get up that high. In the end, when I was there in the 80s, they had actually water from Zongo water. But as with most water systems out there, pretty unreliable.
Jim touches on the key dimension of Zongo regarding radio communication for the folks living across the river in Bangui, Central African Republic.
You bring up the one thing that we kept active in Zongo for a long time, and that was the radio. Because in Bangui, we were not allowed to reply. We could only listen. So if there was something important or something that we had to have a conversation about, we had to cross over and hike it up to the station for the radio. That was the one key thing that we kind of kept in place while over there, and had to do that a couple times.
In March 1980, while on a motorcycle trip with my friend Mark Thornbloom, we got stopped and hassled and delayed by the soldiers at the roadblock entering Zongo. Fortunately, we had our papers in order, and after 3 hours, were allowed to proceed. Jim had an even scarier encounter with the soldiers at Zongo.
I about got jailed because every white guy who was young was, of course, CIA. And so the local authority decided that I was probably CIA, so he had me rounded up and brought up to the jail and questioned. But they decided that CIA didn't speak French and Lingala like I did. So, you know, whatever their end reasons were, I was let go just in time to pop back across the river.
The station had folks living there in the late 1970s and early 1980s, but after that was not fully staffed. It became a way station of sorts.
But I used it a lot for overnights when I had to clear containers, when we got containers stuck on the sandbar in the truck, when I couldn't get customs to do things quickly enough, I'd pop up to the mission and spend the night up there.
Zongo was not a typical acquisition by the mission, as the property was owned by the Congolese church. That partially explains how and why the station never really hit critical mass with a permanent ministry. Yet, it served as a strategic location for ministries to the northeast, and also as a key route in and out of Africa through Bangui for people and supplies. In the early 1970s, Merle Wester was the first missionary to visit the water people villages with several Congolese evangelists. The hospital at Tandala handled patients from both local villages and from afar. And it was in the late 1970s that Dr. Tom Cairns noticed people from the water people coming to Tandala for medical treatment. This was because the Catholic hospital at Bangabolo was no longer functioning very well. The area so designated as, quote, water people, unquote, was a group that lived in and on the river and swampland to the south. Their culture and living was in and around the Ngiri River. The mission determined that this was a relatively unreached group. There had been a lot of Catholic influence, but it was a very watered-down Catholicism. So they decided to allocate some staff to this area. Jack and Flo Lashbaugh moved from Zongo down to Kungu, which was a town about 2 hours south of Tandala. They used Kungu as a staging area and then moved to Limpopo in 1984. Dave and Patsy Alfors arrived a few months later. When the Lashbaughs retired after a few years, Kim and Jan Cohn joined the Alfors in ministry. Limpopo was only about 35 miles south of Tandala as the crow flies, but was completely different in topography and culture. Dave and Patsy Alfors, who worked amongst the water people from 1984 to 1996, described the topography and culture of the water people.
Well, they live in an inundated forest or a swamp, and that means that during rainy season, the streams, rivers, just kind of flood out and take over all of the forest, basically. And then in dry season, of course, it dries up a little bit more. So they call themselves water people, Batunamai, and everybody else in the whole world are land people.
Here is the description of Limpopo.
Limpopo was important because it's where the land and the water people meet. So it has a big market on Fridays when the water people come upriver with their fish and their palm wine, and they like to trade or buy things from the land people so that they have food to eat, like, well, their staples. It could be rice or makembas or kwanga or whatever. And then the land people come to get the fish and the palm oil and the palm wine. So it was important in that sense.
Due to living on a swamp with a high water table, the house construction took this into account.
We had to build our houses a little bit differently because it was so wet. So Ken Landrud helped design a really strong foundation with lots of cement and re-rod, so that the houses could basically float if they needed to. Because sometimes during rainy season, we had water right up to three sides of our house. And then it was six cement blocks high, and then the rest of it was a wood frame and a tin roof.
The station is described thusly.
It was land that was given to the church, and it was just basically in the middle of the village. Just enough that we could build two houses for living, and there was enough land left over for later on to build a dispensary, and the church was also right there. But the church was already established. It wasn't something that we built later.
Different from other typical mission station compounds, Dave and Patsy enjoyed their living arrangements.
Well, it was nice to be living in the village, you know, and not on a separate compound, you know, as such.
We felt much more a part of the community. Right there in the middle of town, everybody can see you and what you're doing, and people can walk in anytime they want, and you know, you're in the village. And so we felt much more a part of it. Early in the morning, the town crier would go through the town saying, okay, today is the day that we're all going to work on the school buildings. All you men bring your machetes and bring, you know, the nelly that's needed, and all you women do this and that. You know, you felt a whole lot more a part of the community rather than being a community all on your own.
The swamp issue impacted some basic living functions.
Well, we did a little bit of study and ended up building a double-vaulted composting latrine. So you're actually building the latrine up above the ground, making a couple of vaults that you can dump into. And then you use one side, one vault, until it's full, close that up, use the other vault, and by the time the other vault is full, hopefully the other one has composted enough, you just dig it out, use it on your fields or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that's what we ended up doing.
Here is how they dealt with electricity.
We used mostly solar, got some solar panels, solar, 12-volt lights. Of course, the fridges were all the kerosene fridge. And then we also did have a small 2,000-watt generator that we could crank up when we needed to. And that was used once a week for laundry, for running the old Maytag wringer washing machines. So that was basically it.
Even though water was everywhere, drinking and domestic water proved a challenge.
For drinking water, we were always worried about that. We had two things that we did. Since we couldn't dig a cistern like the other mission stations, we would have four barrels on a stand that caught rainwater. And so during rainy season, it's no problem. We could use that to filter that for our drinking water. During the dry season, that would also be our drinking water, but we wouldn't use it for washing hands or washing anything else. We dug a hand-dug well first, but that really didn't work.
So what was their purpose for being there?
And Jack and Dave discipled four of the young men from the church to do evangelism, and they became the evangelism team. They would go downriver for a week at a time, usually, and focus on one village, stay there, go door-to-door talking to people during the day, have open-air meetings at night, eventually show the Jesus film. So that was the way we kind of started out and eventually had little churches. When we got there, there was just the one church at Limpopo. It had been started 6 years before we came by a commerçant that worked at Sibi Zaire in Limpopo and a carpenter. When they found out they were both Christians, they started meeting together for prayer and eventually started this little church. So the church was actually going quite well by the time we got there 6 years later. And when we left 12 years later in 1996, there were 16 churches out of the 18 water people villages. So it was amazing to see what God did.
Patsy shared a powerful story about a man that got a fishbone stuck in his throat and it later got infected. It was serious. The locals believed that an evil spirit was the cause and referred to it as the crocodile spirit. They felt he would be paying with his life. Dave and Patsy got him to the Tandala Hospital for medical treatment. I'll let Patsy tell the rest of the story.
Well, we brought Etotea back with us and arranged for him to get to Tandala. Dr. Tom saw him, drained about a cup of pus out of his neck, put him on antibiotics. He was prayed for. He was cared for. And 10 days later, he came back and he was all better. And it was actually a really powerful testimony in his village that God's power is greater than the power of evil spirits. And it made a real impact, I think, on the people to see that that's what we were about and that our God answers prayer and is more powerful than the evil spirits.
The work continued at Limpopo, and when the Alfors and Kim and Jan Cohn moved to Central African Republic in 1996 to start another ministry, there were 16 churches established among the 18 water people villages. They left when they determined that the churches were self-sufficient and the missionaries weren't needed anymore. They'd worked themselves out of a job. Well done. Dave and Patsy ended their careers having served over 40 years with the mission. Dan and Karen Carlson joined Mission Aviation Fellowship, or MAF, in 1985 and began serving as the main aviation team at Carowa a few years later. Dan flew the Cessna airplane for the mission, and Karen handled the radio communications and other business aspects of the ministry. Dan had grown up in Congo, and I knew him growing up as well. Soon after their arrival on the field, they had their first child, a daughter. Shortly thereafter, Karen got pregnant again. The pregnancy period was fine, and it was on a Sunday night at the missionary church service that her water broke. Having had a 2-hour labor with their first child, Karen assumed the same for their anticipated baby named Elizabeth Hope Carlson. They took a long walk on the airstrip to help the labor kick into gear. When they got home, Dr. Helen realized that the umbilical cord was coming out first. Not a good sign. This condition would prevent the baby's descent down the birth canal and possibly prevent the baby from breathing. Karen tells the story.
They got a stretcher and I was on there and she was trying to hold the baby's head up while we were walking down. Got on the table and they had called. Dr. Helen was there. Dr. Leo was there as kind of a backup. And Dr. Kurt was going to actually be doing the C-section. Because at that point, as soon as cord prolapsed, you really have no choice. If you want to save the baby, you just need to go in and get the baby out. They gave me a spinal and they waited because you got to wait till it, you know, kicks in. And it seemed like it was going to kick in. But it didn't. We didn't know that until Kurt came and made the first cut. And by that point, it was real obvious that I was going to feel everything. There wasn't a whole lot that they could do at that point if they even hoped to save our baby's life. And of course, I wouldn't have wanted them to wait. You just needed to go for it. And so they went ahead and opened me up, took Elizabeth out. And then Dr. Helen was there. She was working. She and Leo were working on, you know, the baby, trying to resuscitate probably a good 15 minutes or so. But all I can remember besides just the incredible amount of pain was it was so quiet. It was way too quiet. That's when I knew something was wrong because I should have been able to hear a baby's cry and I didn't. And I said something like, it's not okay, is it? And I don't remember who answered, but they said no. Dan was up by my head holding and being by my head. And then they had different nurses holding me down once they realized that the epidural was not gonna work. As soon as I got the baby out, then okay, well, then we can give you some medication because you couldn't do something like that because that would slow the baby's heartbeat down. They wanted to give her the best chance as possible to live, which was totally the right call. They went to get the medicine, and for some reason it hadn't been stocked. Okay, well, we're going to go ahead and find the pharmacist. Well, they went to get the pharmacist. He had left the key in the village, so he had to go down to the village to get the key and then to come back to get the medication, you know, to give me pain relief and all of that. And so it was a pretty intense night. I just remember crying for God and Jesus. So then they were finally able to stitch me back up and put me on a truck and bounce me back. That wasn't very far, but I sure still kind of felt a lot.
It was Monday, November 13th, 1989. They held the funeral on the porch so Karen could be a part of the service as she was recuperating. People came in from numerous mission stations that morning to be part of it and to support the family.
They did let me hold her before, you know, they put her in the casket. They had made the casket that morning.
Dan tells about the service.
Service was right after noon. And the burial was that afternoon. We sang a few songs. I mean, one was the old Rugged Cross. Uncle Byron did the service. And then another song, One Piece Like a River.
After the service, they drove to the cemetery.
And people would stop, you know, alongside of the road. And I remember this one old Congolese gentleman who had some kind of old hat on and taking his hat off and holding it up to his chest as we went by. And I still had a picture in my mind of, you know, the respect that he showed as we went by. And I'm sure there were others, but that one made an effect on me.
She was buried at Kerawa, so the 18th saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, little Elizabeth Hope Carlson.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
Losing a child at childbirth is extremely traumatic, and Dan and Karen are so thankful to the missionary and Congolese community for their support during this time of loss. Here is how they got through the grieving process.
Well, one of the first lessons that I experienced was that people grieve very differently. As Dan said, he would come and he would just have these huge grieving. I mean, I've never seen anybody cry so hard, and I had never seen him cry so hard than the few times after her passing. And I grieved for a year. I cried every day, not as hard, but just slowly the grief worked its way through until Danielle was born 11 months later. And then all of a sudden, there was some redemption in that.
Probably the first couple days, I just wept my guts out. Just every now and then I'd have to go into the bedroom because it just got too much. And then I was better and things seemed to go pretty well. I would say at least for 6 months, things went pretty well. And then things became a little more normal.
Dan relied on a verse to help him come to terms with the loss.
The only verse that I could really think of was where Job says, "The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." So that's what Mom and Dad put on her plaque that they had made here in the States and then sent out later.
It was a mere 11 months later that their second daughter, Danielle, was born, bringing new joy to their family. I reached out to Danielle to hear about the impact of the family losing Elizabeth at childbirth.
For me, it's kind of a unique perspective because I knew that I wouldn't be here if she had died. I mean, I guess biologically it's possible, but all of us kids are 2 to 2.5 years spaced apart. So I knew if she had lived, because I was born so soon after her death, I wouldn't have been born. And so I kind of grew up feeling like it was my fault, which sounds really, really weird and doesn't totally make sense. I think all of us kids knew that one of the reasons Elizabeth didn't make it was because we were in Congo and because the medical care wasn't what it is here in the States. And so I think we all were very aware of that. We talked about Elizabeth all the time. You know, on her birthday, we would talk about her birth story every year. We often would talk about how we had 4 sisters and 4 brothers. And so she was definitely a part of our life growing up, which I think also probably would connect to just knowing about that peace in heaven too, I think. But I remember as a kid, like crying about the fact that I was supposed to have 2 older sisters and only had 1.
As you heard, Dan and Karen kept the memory of Elizabeth alive as part of their family fabric and culture.
For me, and even for my other siblings too, it just, we knew that it was important that we had an older sister who was in heaven. We knew that she was an important part of our family.
Fast forward 15 years from the loss and a total of 6 more pregnancies and 6 children later, Karen suddenly went through a period where she was not sleeping at night and having major health issues. After some time, she consulted a friend to help figure out what the issue was.
About 15 years after she was born and died, I started not sleeping through the night. And I didn't know why. I had a friend who was very gifted in discerning spirits and in dreams. And she prayed about it. And one night she had a dream and she came to me and she said, "I think God wants us to revisit your time during that night when you were on the operating table." That was like out of the blue. I'm going, "Oh, okay. I want you to tell me where God was, where that all happened." And I said, "Well, I've got an active imagination. I believe that's from God." And I said, "Well, I can see Jesus holding our daughter. I had a time right after she was born where I really searched the scriptures. Will I see my daughter again? Will she be in heaven?" Because she never took that first breath. You know, and there was so much in our culture that says, oh, well, if they haven't breathed, then taken that breath, then they, you know, then they're maybe not a full human. So I really searched the scriptures and came to a very significant and firm conviction that, yes, she is in heaven. I will see her again. And so I said, well, I picture her being in heaven with Jesus. He's holding her. He's rocking her. She's being passed around by, you know, now the grandmothers and all of that. And she said, no, I can see that. But I want you specifically to think of where he was for you. And I probably sat a long time just trying to see where he was for me. And I finally admitted what I never had verbalized or recognized before. And I said, I don't think he was there for me that night. It was just too horrific a night for me. He was there for my daughter, but he wasn't there for me. I finally admitted that because it was kind of locked away in my heart, that little part of my heart that I didn't want to admit and didn't want to open up because it was just too painful. And so she said, okay, God will show you where he was. And I said, okay. I didn't think too much about it. About 2 or 3 days later, I was running around doing our homeschool PE. And all of a sudden, I stopped and I dropped to my knees because I saw where Jesus was that night for me. He had his hands over Dr. Kurt's hands, and he was guiding and directing every single cut that he made. Because can you imagine trying to do a surgery on somebody that's screaming and wiggling and, you know, everything? And he was there. He was absolutely there. So that 11 months later, I could give birth to Danielle naturally with no complications. And then not only after that, but after Elizabeth's birth, I gave birth 6 other times to children all naturally, really without complications. And so when I look at that, oh yes, absolutely, God was there for me. And so I have shared that as when appropriate to other people to say, you know, you may not think that God is there for you in a particular time in your life. You may have a little trauma or a big trauma that's stored away and you don't want to take it out and you don't want to look at it because it's just too painful. But God in his mercy and his timing, he will show you that he was there. He was there all along. He was walking with you, even though you might not have been able to see it or feel it at that time. And so that was one of the times when God really healed an emotion and an experience within seconds, because I was able to see from his perspective. I mean, I still lost the baby, right? I still have a loss.
The revelation of Jesus' hands guiding and holding the hands of the doctor, cutting into unanesthetized Karen during the procedure, is so beautiful. So many things could have gone wrong in those moments, yet Karen was able to deliver 6 more children naturally with no issues. What a blessing, and what a great lesson Karen shared. During the Congo Civil War, the gravesite was desecrated, presumably by the rebel soldiers.
We would get very angry because we found out that somebody had stolen her headstone in Karawa. And we just couldn't believe, you know, that somebody would do that to our sister. But when my parents moved back to the States, all of us siblings felt like we wanted to have something for them because we knew that they were leaving a part of their family overseas. And so we all pitched in together and bought them a memorial bench to have at their house here in Colorado. And so that was something really special that us kids were able to do for my parents.
What a wonderful gesture from all the Carlson children to bless Dan and Karen and to honor their sister, Elizabeth Hope Carlson. I read an article recently by Stephen Lieberman, an attorney, that had a quote that I feel is poignant to Elizabeth. He wrote,
"Our value is not measured in years. It is measured in what we have brought to others. Sometimes we may not even be aware of what that might be."
So though Elizabeth Hope never took a breath, the impact she had on the Carlson family is quite amazing, as you heard. Earlier, you heard mention of Vanette Thorsell, who was one of the first teachers at Botto in the 1940s. She came from a family with a strong heritage in church service, as her grandfather was a pastor. She was born in San Pedro, California in 1916. She graduated from UC Berkeley in 1936 with a degree in Spanish and education. She continued her education at San Francisco State and North Park College, gaining her teaching credential and Bible and theological training. On July 10, 1945, Vanette was commissioned by the Covenant Church for missionary service in the Belgian Congo. The special song at her service was, "Follow, I Will Follow Thee." An appropriate song indeed to send her off to a life of following Christ and serving in missions. She arrived in the Belgian Congo the following year, where for the next 37 years she taught in elementary and secondary schools in Gemena, Karawa, Botto, and Bolengi. Thousands of her students observed her faithfulness in serving others and her strong witness to the gospel of Christ. Another side of her was her desire to plant trees. I remember her when she moved to Gemena while I was in high school in the 1970s. The first thing she did after unpacking was start planting trees in her yard, mango, avocado, and some citrus. She firmly believed in having fruit and shade in her environment. Vanette retired in 1983 from Congo, but in 1985, due to a shortage of teachers, she returned for a year as a short-termer. She then returned to Congo three other times to fill in where teachers were needed. During one of her times in Congo, she fell ill. She had surgery for an intestinal obstruction at the Karawa Hospital. Although at first she seemed to be improving, a second surgery was required 6 days later. In her weakened state, she was unable to recover. She died that day at 1:30 p.m. It was Monday, November 19, 1990. Funeral services were held at Karawa the following day. Reverend Luyada, the vice president of the Covenant Church in Congo, led the service. She was buried at the Karawa Cemetery. So the 19th saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, Vanette Thorsell.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
I reached out to quite a few people to collect some Vanette stories and memories. I will share a few. Vanette was nicknamed Moving Van by her fellow missionaries, and that moniker followed her for decades. I thought it was due to Aunt Van's constant moving from one station to another. However, I was able to track down where that nickname came from. Thanks to Dan Noren for this backstory. Well, there was another lady named Vera Loden that lived at Botto with Vanette. Someone said the following when Vanette was packing up to relocate one time.
When you're moving van, you need Vera Loden.
Get it? Dan Noren thinks Don Lundquist came up with that as he was apparently witty with words. Regardless, that's the story. Vanette was a force of nature. There are stories of her incredible feats of faith. As a single lady, she tackled road trips alone and was just all around tough. Craig Wickstrom tells of the following encounter.
We'd gone up there, and as we were getting ready to leave, somebody was asking for a ride, or I can't remember what the conversation was, but what I remember was the comment that, "Aren't there any women in the United States?" referring to Vanette and Donna Larson, because they were both so tough, you know. I just saw them as not being the typical image that they had of women.
Aunt Van truly devoted her life to the Congolese, and they knew that and desired that relationship to continue. She had a constant stream of visitors at her house. And since she'd taught for so many years before the 1960 independence, when education in the Congo was minimal, many of her students secured high positions in the church, education, commerce, public health, and government after independence. So when she went to Kinshasa, the capital, she knew so many people. Thelma Landrude shared about being in Kinshasa with Vanette on a trip together.
But I was in Kinshasa with her one time. And that was what impressed me. That lady knew somebody wherever we turned up.
And I said, this is what teachers in the Ubangi, I mean, when you realize that they were teaching the people that became the leaders in the country. And so when they went to Kinshasa, that's when they would start meeting people that they knew from way back when.
In summary, Vannette was indeed a force of nature and a huge impact on thousands of students over the decades. And she knew how to have true relationship with the Congolese. She loved the Congolese and returned multiple times after she retired. I was told that Dr. Roger Thorpe thought she had wanted to come back out to Congo so she could die there and be buried there. Rest in peace, Aunt Vannette. In 1991, President Mobutu was losing his grip on the country. There was talk of a coup d'etat or a sharing of the power. The country was not doing well economically. And after having been ruled for 26 years by the dictator Mobutu, the people were ready for change. Riots and other violence started to happen in Kinshasa, the capital. Though many felt that the political violence wouldn't reach the Ubangi region, both the Free Church and Covenant Mission Boards felt it necessary to evacuate their staff. So they did. Unsure as to how long the political turmoil would continue, many moved to Central African Republic or Cameroon to continue working in ministry until things cooled off in Congo. Then, in 1992, some of the missionaries returned to Congo when things were stable again. It should be noted that during the 1991 evacuation, the Free Church had already planned a full handoff of their missionary work in 1996. They had been working with the local church leaders towards this goal. Though the missionary role was clearly different between the mission and the church, the staffing and financial support of the schools and hospitals was still a critical part of the ongoing operations. But as any good mission group needs to do, they hoped to wean the daughter church to be independent. This means in leadership, laymen, finances, pastoral, and the entire organization. Furthermore, since the economy was always in turmoil with the nationalization, the devaluation of money, and other things, the average financial position of a person was worse than in the 1960s. Thus, the tithes and offerings to support the church operations were always a challenge to meet the budget. So with the 1991 evacuation due to political instability, the Free Church accelerated their transition plan by 5 years and told the Congolese church that they'd be on their own from that point forward. The cutoff was not cold turkey, but not all the missionaries returned in 1992, and the role of the Home Office became more as advisory and support and guidance. The Covenant continued to staff missionaries, but here too, fewer returned in 1992 than had evacuated. Things continued on in this lesser role by both mission groups for about 5 years. Then, in 1997, Laurent Kabila, the rebel leader from the 1964 Simba Rebellion, started marching across the country from east to west. His soldiers looted, raped, and pillaged as they made their way to Kinshasa. He was going to overthrow Mobutu, and this time he wouldn't be denied. It is estimated that between 3 and 5 million people perished during the civil war. Many by bullets as the rebel soldiers advanced. Many died, however, by being forced into the forest for personal safety reasons and being subject to bad water, minimal food, and disease. In Gemena, the church leaders had most of the properties looted, and equipment and supplies were stolen by the rebels as they took over various mission stations and towns. Vehicles, radios, and other items used to handle the church administration were stolen, destroyed, or confiscated. And with most church attendees fleeing into the forest for survival, the normal church model was turned on its head. Yet, the church, which isn't just a building, consists of people. And the people continued to move forward in spite of being uprooted. Prayer meetings, church services, and ongoing biblical teaching continued during those years of upheaval and danger in the forest and remote villages. If you would like to hear the specifics of this time period in Congo, I encourage you to listen to part of my podcast series on the history of Congo, specifically episode 22. the CECU continued to stay strong, and even when peace returned to the region, membership had grown, even though church buildings had been damaged, burned, or fallen down. This, to me, is an indicator that the mission work had done its job, and the fruit of that work was revealed, even in the most difficult circumstances. Faith in God prevailed during the Civil War. This was a testament to all the missionaries and the Congolese pastors, leaders, and laymen. After the Civil War in 1997 and 1998, the Free Church and Covenant Missions effectively stopped staffing people on the field. The Free Church pulled out completely, and the Covenant only had a handful of people return in the late 1990s and into the 2000s. And these folks were in a pastoral and church leadership support role. Effectively, the mission model that had been in place for decades was no longer needed. The Free Church and Covenant had done their jobs. They'd left an autonomous church in Congo. In conclusion of this sixth episode in the series, we discussed two evacuations due to political unrest, the completion of the Bible translation into the Ngbaka language, the establishment of FATEB, where many went for seminary education, and the turmoil of the government's push for nationalization. And there were the people that gave their lives in the process: Clarice Hogberg, Elizabeth Carlson, Vanette Thorsell, and Dr. Titus Johnson, the founder of our mission. From a girl that never took a breath, to a short-termer, to a career person, and the visionary. All played a vital part in the mission's success, but gave their lives for the effort. The Free Church has online archives, and Dr. Tom Cairns and Dr. Tim Wester forwarded considerable materials to help me with my preparation for this episode. Special thanks to Sig Westberg and Francis Mason for their work in writing the biography of the life and work of Titus Johnson titled Deep Tracks in Africa. Also, Ole Olberg wrote a master's thesis in 1973. Having these written documented resources is great for purposes of preserving history, and their efforts are to be acknowledged. To Jim Aiken and the Alfors, I say thank you for adding to the mission spotlight for Zongo and the Water People Ministry in Limpopo. And to those that shared about the passing of their child or sibling or friend, I want to thank Marianne Algren, Dr. Maynard Hogberg and his sister Ramona, Dan Carlson, Karen Carlson, and Danielle Carlson Carlberg. Thanks also to the many folks who provided voiceovers for the characters in this episode to help bring more reality to these stories. David Olberg quoted several paragraphs from his father's master's thesis called The History of the Zaire Mission, 1922 to 1975. This thesis provided excellent details as to the church's growth and development through the years. I also want to bring special recognition to Rick Saleen, who was the voice of Dr. Titus Johnson throughout these first six episodes. In the final episode of this seven-part series, we will present the period of 1998 to 2022 of our mission work in Congo. You will hear about how the church moved forward after the 1997 Civil War, with the missionaries not returning to the field, and how the church carried on. There was also a huge celebration marking the 100-year anniversary of the mission work that was held in 1922, and a recap of the efforts spanning 100 years. There is also one more person who passes away. Thanks for listening, and I hope you continue the journey with me and listen to the final episode of Trials and Triumphs in Congo, a 100-year mission journey. So that concludes this episode. I hope you enjoyed it and will listen again. Other podcasts and blog articles on a variety of topics can be found at congokid.net. In addition, Congo Kid's life stories are also posted on Apple iTunes, Google Podcast, and Spotify. I'm Jeff Eales, a.k.a. Congo Kid, your humble host. Until next time, I will send you off with a farewell in Lingala. Baninga nangai, tikala malamu. My friends, stay well.